Hello, and welcome to another episode of Tea at the Palace. This is the new podcast where myself, royal biographer and filmmaker Robert Hardman, and fellow royal expert, historian, and commentator Wesley Kerr, take you beyond the palace gates. We explore the great royal stories of modern times and the stories behind the stories.
It'll be a weekly treat of memories, anecdotes, and insight in the company of those who really know what's been going on behind those gates. This week, we take a really significant period in royal history, August to December 1997, from after the death of Diana to the decommissioning of the Royal Yacht Britannia, a tumultuous period.
It really is one of the turning points, I think, a pivotal moment in the royal story, Wes. And I think, really, to set the scene, we probably need to rewind and just remember the atmosphere in the streets of London and indeed around the country in those days.
August 1997, the horrific news on a Sunday morning that Diana had been killed in Paris in a car crash, a thunderbolt.
What I say to you now, as your queen and as a grandmother, I say from my heart. First, I want to pay tribute to Diana myself. She was an exceptional and gifted human being. In good times and bad, she never lost her capacity to smile and laugh, nor to inspire others with her warmth and kindness. I admired and respected her for her energy and commitment to others, and especially for her devotion to her two boys.
What an extraordinary day. And Wes, I think you were literally just below where the Queen was
speaking. I was outside the palace and I was teeing in the clip on the BBC News, and actually I was on the same outside broadcast unit as the Queen. So I heard her rehearsing, heard her say just one run through. And then 3 hours before, she had got out of the car with Philip, having come back from Scotland. There'd been all that criticism. And as it were, braved the crowds, and you felt the crowd's emotion change. I think as an event to witness, as an afternoon to be there, it was astonishing. And what amazing leadership from her.
It was, I think, one of the moments of the reign for so many reasons. But I think let's move on from that tragic week, because I think what we're going to look at today is what happened next, the sort of the turnaround. I mean, that week has been very well documented. I'm sure we'll come onto it in another episode. They've even made an Oscar-winning film about it.
Yeah, my commentary as the Queen gets out of the car was used in the film.
Oh,
the
you're
Queen.
In the film.
Yes, I was a bit surprised in the okay. cinema around
right.
that time. This great
Hollywood
film.
Star thought, we have with us today.
Yes, yeah. I thought, oh, whose voice is that? But it just shows that it's one of the most significant moments, not only in the Queen's reign, but in modern British history, because Diana was such an immensely popular figure. And in a way, I suppose, you know, her way of doing monarchy challenged the institution. And the Queen and the family had, in a way, to fight back. The beginning of the fight back was that speech.
Well, I think it was more of a sort of, how do they navigate a way to the next phase of modern royalty? I mean, things had to change. I mean, what I remember so clearly is that there wasn't any time, really, for the Queen to draw breath. I mean, very soon after this, as you call it, tumultuous week, I mean, the Queen was off on a very important state visit to Pakistan and then to India to mark the 50th anniversary of independence. And Prince Charles, he had to come to terms with the fact he was a single parent. He had a very important visit lined up to Southern Africa. He was going to the coronation of the King of Lesotho. He was going to Swaziland. And more importantly, he was going to meet Nelson Mandela and spend some time with him and attend a Spice Girls concert. But it was half term. William was staying with friends. What about Harry? Harry came along too. I mean, suddenly we were seeing these extraordinary sights, weren't we?
And those kids had lost their mother. There was all this criticism of the institution, but everything was telescoped, of course. Diana's dead on the 31st. There's all this criticism. The funeral is less than a week after her death. So people think, looking back, that it was a much longer period of time. But the royal show, as it were, had to go on. They had to go on with all these duties. I think you were on the tour when Charles met the Spice Girls.
I remember watching one of the Spice Girls pinch his posterior.
My goodness.
Which Harry found very funny. And there was clearly a great rapport between Prince Charles and Nelson Mandela. I mean, that was a great thing to see, because here was suddenly this key figure on the global landscape who had this very strong relationship with the Queen. I mean, Mandela and the Queen was one of the great friendships. And he was on his way. I mean, just in that period, those weeks, he was on his way over to Britain for a Commonwealth summit, which the Queen was hosting in Edinburgh. So hot off this great crisis, the royal family, there was no question of hiding away. They were absolutely there in the front line. At the same time, everyone was looking to see signs of a change, of some sort of modernisation.
A change of tone. So in that speech, she said that we've learned lessons from Diana. So how was this very ancient institution and the Queen in her 70s, Philip and his elderly people, really, how are they going to seem different and to maybe emote more?
Yeah.
But and actually, maybe they did successfully do that without seeming to change. It was that classic thing in the rain that she's a swan gliding gently over the water but pedalling furiously underneath.
Well, certainly it wasn't all doom and gloom during those months. I think what was coming up fairly soon after some of these big moments, these big tours, was a rather happy moment. Well, two happy moments, I suppose. Firstly, Windsor Castle had suffered that terrible fire in 1992. But actually, contrary to expectations, it was not only rebuilt, it was looking rather better, wasn't it?
Talking about a phoenix rising from the ashes, I happened to be there the day of the fire, and it was somewhere I'd loved all my life to see it. So, you know, all that smoke, all those flames going seemingly hundreds of feet up into the sky, it was horrific. But yet, 5 years later, almost to the day, and what coincided with the wedding anniversary, 50th wedding anniversary of Philip and Elizabeth, it was restored. And in some ways, it was better because some quite cranky rooms went up. So instead of a timber ceiling, you had a sort of modern timber ceiling in St. George's Hall. All the roots around were better. They discovered a medieval kitchen that nobody had sort of seen. So oddly enough, it was somehow better presented, which I suppose if you've got a castle which is 1,000 years old, it's sort of had fires before.
Yeah.
But it was a fantastic example of doing something, restoring it ahead of time and under budget. And of course, to pay for it, they'd opened Buckingham Palace. Yeah. So it's that classic thing in the royal family or in the monarchy. When there's adversity, you try and find a creative way to make things better.
As one of the Queen's private secretaries once said to me, you know, whenever there's a crisis, you've always got to try and drag the positives out of it. And it was so interesting that just after Windsor was restored and reopened to the world, there we had more good news, a very happy moment, which is you've just touched on there, which was the golden wedding anniversary of the Queen and the Duke. And when you think during the 90s of all the domestic problems, the royal separations, the royal divorces, at last, here you had 50 years of what would actually go on to be the longest royal marriage in history. But here were the Queen and the Duke, and they were celebrating all that they'd been through together. And it was very uplifting, actually. And I think we're just going to hear one of a few clips. The first was Prince Philip reflecting on 50 years of being married to the sovereign.
I think that the main lesson that we've learned is that tolerance is the one essential ingredient of any happy marriage. It may not be quite so important when things are going well, but it is absolutely vital when things get difficult. And you can take it from me that the Queen has the quality of tolerance and abundance.
It's a universal truth from Philip, but it's also quite personal. But people have often wondered what exactly he meant. It's sort of quizzical and powerful what he said there.
It was a wonderful speech because these two, they never really talk that much in public about, you know, how much they meant to each other. But over those 2 days, and this was over 2 days, we had Prince Philip speak one day, and then the next day was a service at Westminster Abbey, followed by a lunch given by the Prime Minister. And over those 2 days, I think particularly given the backdrop of what the family had been through that year and over those few years of the 90s, it was, as you say, it was immensely powerful. And I think what we might hear next is Tony Blair really speaking on behalf of the country to the couple the following day at the banqueting house in Whitehall.
You are our Queen. We respect and cherish you. You are simply the best of British. So may I invite all of our guests to join me in wishing you and Prince Philip many further happy years together with the assurance of the united affection of your people here and throughout the Commonwealth.
I think that's very significant because this is the new energetic prime minister who seemingly had been slightly at odds, it had been reported, over reacting to Diana, but actually he's giving them his absolute endorsement. So this is them going to the future. And then I think the Queen responds unusually warmly in one of the great speeches of her reign. This was at the banqueting house. And she's both political and intensely personal. So she talks about the challenges of the institution, which is possibly a back reference to how they'd handled Diana. But she then gives the most warm and personal remarks to Philip, just a sort of incredible thanks for that togetherness.
He is someone who doesn't take easily to compliments, but he has quite simply been my strength and stay all these years. And I and his whole family, and this and many other countries, owe him a debt greater than he would ever claim, or we shall ever know.
Well, that was one of the most quoted, repeated lines of the Queen's entire reign, actually. I mean, when I remember when Prince Philip died, we heard that line played over and over again, and it was so true. I mean, it was so authentic. It was so sincere. And I think those 2 days, didn't they, Wes, they kind of gave the monarchy a sort of a renewed sense of, look, it's going to be okay. You know, this isn't so bad after all.
We saw how this relationship, these two, perhaps in the whole thousand-year history of the monarchy, this was almost the most important and powerful relationship beyond Victoria and Albert, because it lasted almost three times as long as that. So you see what a powerful foundation the reign had and what an incredible partnership there was. When they would be at a banquet abroad, they would be at different tables, but they'd always be seated so that they could look at each other. And you and I have both seen them. We've seen him like fiddling with his cufflinks and sort of fiddling with his hair before she comes into a room. If he's coming into a room, she smiles and lifts. So it was a great love story.
I think also it's interesting to hear Tony Blair there, because as you said, this is the very early days of the Blair government, a new Labour government, very radical reforming government that really hadn't given very much thought to the monarchy at all, and suddenly found itself firstly having to deal with the death of Diana. And then there's Blair hosting this lunch. And I've interviewed Blair about this actually for my book. And he said, you know, looking back on his entire premiership, that was one of the happiest days as Prime Minister. It wasn't a lunch of just the great and the good. I think Prince Philip was sitting next to a farmer's wife from Yorkshire. The Queen was sitting next to a jockey. I mean, they had a sort of whole cross-section of society there. It did bring home, as I say, the sense of not a new beginning, but there were foundations, there were aspects of the monarchy that weren't in crisis, that were tough and strong and were going to endure. And that marriage was one of them. What's extraordinary, though, is this remarkable run of events, happy, sad, undoubtedly pivotal, if you like, to the royal story. It weren't over. I mean, there was another landmark moment coming up at the end of 1997, which clearly moved all the royal family, as we all saw at the time. And that, of course, was the decommissioning of the Royal Yacht Britannia, perhaps the Queen's favourite home, would it be fair to say?
Oh, they so loved it, didn't they? Because it was fitted out right at the beginning of the reign. And they said it was really the only home where they'd chosen their own furniture. And they could be at peace, especially on the Western Isles tour, which we'll hear about. But it enabled Britain to be afloat. And it was the most amazing ship. You and I have spent time on it. What an amazing boat it was.
Embassy, palace, enclave, retreat, showroom for the UK. Well, we're going to hear all about that now, because we're incredibly lucky to have with us as our guest today a man who knows far more about this than either of us, because he was the last commanding officer of Britannia. Commodore Anthony Morrow actually served three times on the yacht, but had the very great honour of taking her through her final years. Tony, first of all, let me ask you what it is you've brought in. We ask everyone for their piece of memorabilia. What's yours?
Well, I decided to bring in the official programme ready for the paying off ceremony of the decommissioning of Britannia, which took place on the 11th of December 1997, a day that all of us who served or were close with Britannia, as indeed were you, Robert, in terms of, I think, being there on the day.
Yeah.
We'll remember it so fondly.
Well, thank you for bringing that in. That we'll definitely come on to that very shortly. But Tony, just give us a rough idea of the sort of ship we're talking about here?
Well, Britannia was originally designed, laid down as going to be a cross-channel ferry. In fact, with the Labour government, Attlee's government in the early 50s, decided really to support the ailing king, as he was then, George VI, to create a replacement to the Victoria and Albert, which would have made Britannia, I think it was the 82nd royal yacht that the country has ever had. Really? So there's a huge history behind this.
But it's so interesting. People have this idea of it being incredibly grand, but as you say, the actual blueprint was based on the design for a cross-channel ferry. I mean, that's
very remarkable. Simple, very simple. But of course, it needed to be made into a royal yacht. And I think this is where the design team, particularly supported and assisted by the Queen herself, the late Queen herself, and Prince Philip, who really had a major part in discussion of design to make it simple and straightforward, very much as a sort of country-style home.
And it amazing service it did. I mean, huge number of tours, many nautical miles. What was the sort of crew?
Well, it was crewed, again, very much in the 50s stage, because she was a steam-driven ship. She needed to have a lot of engineers to make sure the ship could stay at sea for day after day after day. So that was very important in terms of endurance, the fueling, and the management of the ship's company. And in fact, with a total ship's company of 250 total, including a Royal Marine Band, made it very special.
But the thing that always struck me was when you came on board and you think, I'm going into a royal residence, this is a royal yacht. I think people expected, you know, grand portraits and chandeliers and red carpet everywhere. Actually, it's very understated. I mean, it has that feel, almost like a sort of a, I always think they reminded me of a sort of drawing room, of a sort of country vicarage rather
well,
than a palace.
It was indeed like that, which reminds me really of the moment when Chris Patten left Britannia in Hong Kong, and we were away from really a remarkable part of that final year of 1997. And Chris Patten wrote to me afterwards to thank me for looking after him and his family on board and reminding me of the country house atmosphere that Britannia created. And it was so typical. And he saw that at the end.
Now, Tony, let me rewind a little, because this wasn't your first time in the Royal Yacht, was it? I mean, you had been as a junior officer, I think. You'd sort of seen her from the other end in another age. Tell us about your first experience in Britannia.
Well, thank you, Robert. No, I was very overwhelmed as a very junior officer, as a sub-lieutenant, in fact. So very much one of my first appointments in the Royal Navy was to serve as a barge officer, the Royal Barge Officer, as a watchkeeping officer on Britannia. And that was back in the mid-60s. A very special 2 years. But it wasn't just looking after the barge. I mean, I was the ship's or Britannia's film officer, because we had films on board in those days.
Uh-huh.
And the wonderful moment of being able to introduce for Her Majesty and the royal family to see was one of the very early James Bond films.
And then you came back again. Obviously, your career continued in the Royal Navy, or the Grey Navy, as I think everybody calls it. But then you came back again in a very key period in the mid-70s, didn't you?
The mid-70s were two remarkable years, and I was appointed again back to Britannia as the communications officer, in fact, known on board as the Royal Cipher Officer, because it was a very important part of royal communications to make sure that they were managed properly when Her Majesty and the royal family were on board. But those 2 years, 1976 was the bicentenary for the States, and going across the Atlantic to do a fabulous royal tour on the east coast of the States, with Queen and Prince Philip, to be followed almost immediately by the Olympic Games in Montreal.
Oh, Princess Anne was taking part.
And she was, Princess Anne was indeed taking part there, and we had all members of the royal family with us, the immediate family. And then, of course, coming back to the UK, I'm pretty sure we did the Western Isles at that stage. But then, of course, that was the build-up to the most amazing year, 1977, which was the Silver Jubilee year. And that took Britannia around the world. We left at the late end of December 76 so that we could do virtually the entire year of 1977 performing royal duties abroad. So it was out to New Zealand, Australia, back home for the UK's silver anniversary. Western Isles, again, of course, was an important part of it, before then going out to the Caribbean and doing these final parts of the Silver Jubilee tour throughout the Caribbean. An amazing year.
So these are astonishing journeys, but you keep talking about the Western Isles. So this sounds like some secret tour.
No, it was a lovely part of Britannia's life. I think the most important part was that we all understood how little real holiday Her Majesty and the family had. And to be able to take Britannia for about 10 to 12 days, perhaps, up to the Western Isles, where they could have time on their own.
We're talking the Western Isles of Scotland.
Western Isles of Scotland.
But you'd start in Portsmouth, so the Duke would have done Cowes Week.
Probably, yes.
The Queen would board in Portsmouth, and then you would go the...
Southampton, and
then you'd go to Cornwall and round
up the west coast, up into really the area that they would like.
So you'd go past Ireland as well, then.
Yes,
And this was an annual 10-day holiday with the whole family and
Not
Princess
necessarily
Margaret's.
The whole family.
But Princess Margaret's children would join.
They came on previous occasions. Some of them came right at the very end as well for the final tour that we had.
And would you stop for picnics at sort of islands and things?
Absolutely. We would go, we would always have a royal escort with us so that we were safe and secure.
A naval ship, yes.
But we would make up the programme. Obviously, there was a great consultation that would take place usually between the commanding officer, and I remember that very fondly, towards the end with Prince Philip. We would take the charts up into the royal drawing room and discuss the next day's programme and
so
where
he
the
he was a sailor again.
But oh, yeah. Very much so.
I imagine the Queen joined in as well. I mean, from what I gathered, they'd all say, can we have a picnic there? Can we have a picnic there? As a commanding officer, you'd have to say, well, I'm afraid we can't anchor there because there are rocks.
Well, things like that, or the choice of where they particularly wanted to go, take the barbecue equipment ashore and let Prince Philip get on and get
which
a barbecue
which he had designed
ready.
Himself.
Oh, yes, very much so. But, and the chefs on board had made sure that obviously the things were going to be there for him.
So, Tony, getting back to this great cruise around the Western Isles of Scotland, of course, the whole point was then to get the Queen up to Balmoral, wasn't it? So you'd go right along the top of Scotland.
Very much so. We would end up going into Scrabster so that we could perhaps visit the Queen Mother at Castle of May, which was always a very poignant moment because she very much loved seeing Britannia.
It was always said Britannia made a great entrance, but she would also make a great exit as well. And I think perhaps no greater exit than your last big assignment, which was, of course, to hand over Hong Kong. Bring the Prince of Wales and the last governor, Chris Patten, out of Hong Kong. Just tell us about the logistics of that. You had to get this yacht that by then had done, over 1 million miles. All the politicians said she was past it. And yet there you were, sailing halfway around the world and back again.
Well, it was remarkable, but there was absolutely no pressure from our point of view. We had all the utmost confidence in Britannia being able to undertake these tours. And, you know, if we had little problems, we would overcome them quite quickly. But there was never anything that was of great consequence. We had a remarkable 7-month deployment that final year, Britannia's 44th year in service, that took us through the Mediterranean, the Gulf, Pakistan, India, Bangkok, and eventually to Japan, which, of course, was another very special first-time ever visit for Britannia, first and last, of course. And that was one of the things that I ensured went into the program because Britannia had never visited Japan. And in terms of that particular occasion, this was building up to going to Hong Kong to have all the major industrial members of the Japanese commercial community coming on board was something remarkable to see them. You would not miss an invitation such as that, and they did not, and they really appreciated it.
Yeah, your role in promoting British trade, I mean, that was extraordinary. It was often said that Britannia helped seal contracts, not just in the millions, but in the billions.
Yeah, very much so. And it was a fundamental part of Britannia's, the sort of second half of her life, I think, really. It probably started in the while we were in the States in 76, I think was one of the very first sea days that we had on Britannia. And they dominated a lot of the, combination of the royal visits as well as the commercial visits.
So it was an incredibly useful ship as well as being a beautiful ship.
Well, it's more than useful. I mean, she really benefited the nation hugely.
So in a way, it's sad that it was decommissioned, but also I suppose it shows that the Queen recognised political reality, that neither the John Major government nor the Tony Blair government wanted to decommission it in the political context of the times. And I suppose they just moved to more modern forms of transport.
Well, I think it was in the end, as a result of the political decisions that were made, dare I say, had been regretted in lots of cases about it, because Britannia, in all that she did, provided so much benefit for the country as a whole, the nation as a whole. And I think that we who served there can remember that fondly and also regard it as something that was never fully, totally recognised.
I mean, Tony, we're talking about the tail end of 1997, that extraordinary year. It was only a few months before that Britannia had undertaken one of the most high-profile events of her entire career. That was the handover of Hong Kong back to the Republic of China. And you were sent out there to take the Prince of Wales, the governor, to take Britain out of Hong Kong. Tell us about that evening.
Well, it was an extraordinary visit at the end, very special. Hong Kong, from a naval point of view and a national point of view, was always very remarkably part of our ethos and our overall life. So to be there for, dare I say it, another royal occasion, saying goodbye to a place, was not particularly unusual. But nevertheless, because it was Hong Kong and the situation that it was, the back end of that summer was very special to do. It was Tony Blair as the new prime minister then, was the first prime minister of the new era to be on Britannia. Interesting. He asked me when I invited him to have a quick tour of Britannia, whether, as he understood it, Britannia was about to crack up. And I assured the prime minister that very day that we would be sailing that night for the longest, fastest, non-stop passage that Britannia had done in her 44 years. I think it went largely over his head, but nevertheless, he learnt very definitely from that. And I couldn't blame him. We knew Britannia an awful lot better than he did.
And then that brings us to the ceremony. You brought us your order of service from that day. Everybody knows how moved the Queen was that day. It's one of the few occasions, I think, when we've seen tears in her eyes in public. Tell us about your feelings and the feelings of the men of Britannia that day as you all effectively said goodbye.
It was a remarkably special day, but of course it had been in the making for a long time. I mean, I knew that when I joined Britannia in early 1995, that the end was going to be at the end of 97, and I had to prepare for this. And I don't think we've seen a ship being decommissioned, taken out of service in the way that Britannia was at the end. We had a big build-up to that, getting the program for the day managed. We made this remarkable program, the beginning of which there was a wonderful piece that was signed by Her Majesty the Queen then and Prince Philip. And it just says, together with members of my family, Prince Philip and I join you today to pay tribute to Britannia and give our thanks to all who've been part of her company. And she carried on the most remarkable tribute to Britannia. So there was a huge amount of feeling that was going on that day. Yes, it was December. Yes, there was a cold wind blowing across the faces of everybody as we listened to the Royal Marine Band playing Auld Lang Syne and Highland Cathedral to pay her off. And it really was full of feeling. It was a remarkable day for the royal family. It was, I think, if I remember correctly, the largest collection of or members of the royal family being outside London all together in one place that day. Very sadly, Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother, wasn't with us then, but we had so many members of the royal family to pay farewell to Britannia. What a tribute it was and how special it was for us all.
And I think that evening you had a farewell dinner where, correct me if I'm wrong, and it was a private dinner, but I think the Prince of Wales made the shortest speech of his life when he stood up after dinner and said, "I just want to get blindly, madly drunk," and then he sat down again. Am I wrong?
No, not in the slightest. I think you're dead right, Robert. It wasn't a wonderful end to the day itself, though, because he stayed on with us.
So the memory lives on. The ship can be visited in Scotland. Bits of it are still on the Windsor estate. So it was a recognition from the Queen that times had changed. But it's a very, very powerful memory of an amazing symbol of Britain.
Amazing symbol of Britain, a great maritime nation. We had a history of royal yachts, as I think I mentioned earlier, going back to Charles II's reign. And I mean, to have that feeling and within the maritime nation that we are proud to be a fundamental member of is something that I think will, and I hope, live with us all always, because that is the important part. Sad that we no longer have a royal yacht, but that was history in the making.
When I met the Queen on Britannia, she always seemed amazingly relaxed. There were no flunkies around her. She was just like a society lady entertaining you in her drawing room. But you must have had even more intimate moments than that.
Well, there were many moments around. I mean, the one occasion where the officers were asked by the Queen, this was on the way home from the Finland state visit in 1976, before we went out to America. We were coming back through the Kiel Canal, and the Queen had made it quite clear that she had asked the Admiral, who was in command at the time, to let her know when we were passing a certain ranch of horses. And we all know Her Majesty's love of horses. And it didn't happen.
Uh-oh.
And that night, I had been invited as one of two or three officers to have dinner with Her Majesty. Not connected to that at all, but we knew that Her Majesty was pretty upset by this at all. And at one moment, we thought she wasn't even going to turn up for dinner.
Right.
We had let her down significantly badly.
How did she express that to you?
Well, she eventually arrived ready for dinner, looking rather gloomy. And then very quietly, as we sat down for dinner, she took her napkin out and folded it away very quickly and changed her appearance and her smile instantly to one of enjoying it. She knew that we got it wrong, and she didn't get upset by that.
But glorious moment. She loved the band. I remember standing two away from her for Beat the Retreat in the Bahamas, and she would be like tapping her fingers. She loved having that Marines band on the ship.
It was a very special part of the arrangement that we had, and I think it was so wonderful that we could always take a Royal Marine band with us wherever we went. And it was a sort of hallmark item of Britannia's visits. And loved by them.
What were the picnics like on deserted islands?
They were very simple, very straightforward, very relaxed. Hopefully we'd keep the press away and that sort of thing. It was very important that they were not a part of it. I think really the enjoyment was a relaxed enjoyment, really. People were enjoying that opportunity to see Her Majesty relaxed, very much so. And I think I always remember one occasion during the last, I think it was during the last Western Isles, fond memory that I had. Her Majesty had stayed on board while she was obviously continuing to do some work or whatever. And obviously, as the Commodore, I would wait for her to take her ashore to join the rest of the family who were ashore getting the picnic ready. And so I went down to the Royal Quarters to see when Her Majesty was ready. And she was wonderfully just managing the family photograph album at the time. And it was lovely to see Her Majesty doing just that. And she looked up at me and she said, "Well, Tony, when I'm ready, I'll let you know." And I'm almost there. So we've done our photograph album for the day. And that was a lovely moment. We then went to the Royal Barge and went ashore and had a lovely picnic.
So what an extraordinary end that was to 1997, one of the pivotal years in the modern royal story. The lessons learned, the way in which monarchy has to adapt, evolve, look forward. The Queen took all that on board. There were big things coming up very shortly afterwards. There was a new millennium. There was a golden jubilee. There was a royal wedding just 2 years away. So these are all things to be discussed in future episodes of Tea at the Palace. For now, it just remains for me to thank our guest, Commodore Anthony Morrow, and from Wesley Kerr, and from myself, Robert Hardman, until next time. Thank you.